This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Highways to the north, south, and west are clogged with frantic human traffic.
So you're going to build eco-cities? Don't make me laugh. Just as green mayors finally arrive, the financial collapse is draining cities into poverty. San Francisco has almost $500 million in revenue shortfall. Vancouver is slashing, starting with a 40-year-old plant conservatory. The only stimulus left is for the banksters and dinosaur highway projects. It's time to call in Richard Register, one of the inventors of the ecological city concept. He knows the time is late, the climate is damaged, energy is declining along with the economy. Now Richard is going to take you on a lightning tour around the world with visions from even the poorest people with better ways to live. Maybe the big change will give us back living spaces to love. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In our second half hour, we'll explore the currents of microscopic toxins that swirl around the globe right into our homes and our bloodstreams. We'll go chasing molecules with investigative author Elizabeth Grossman. Then we'll get some expert tips on cutting your personal footprint up to 40%. That's the economical environmentalist Prashant Fazi from London. But first, from the Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, this is Oakland's Richard Register.
In the title of my talk is Time of Crisis, When the Visionary Becomes the Practical. You know, how do we actually live? How do we actually build our communities, and how do we live in those communities? And the visionary has to become practical pretty soon, or we're in real trouble. And we all know that. I think we all realize that with climate change and species extinction and so on, we're in a real crisis situation, and we need to come up with the best ideas about the overall larger patterns that are shaping our lives. Well, a few nights ago, I was at a dinner that was sponsored by Climate Work. You may have heard of them. They fund a lot of research on climate change. And the guy that was sitting two seats from me has saved the world. I mean, this is not figurative. This is absolutely literal. I was sitting next to a guy that saved the world. Now, who would this guy actually be? His name is Mario Molino, and he's the person who discovered something was perilously wrong with the CFCs in the atmosphere, that you couldn't just spray your hair and your paint and run refrigeration units without some kind of a cost in the upper stratosphere. We had a real problem there. And back around 1973, when he was looking at these figures, like in this movie, how many of you have seen When Worlds Collide in 1951? A scientist sees, an astronomer sees a planet coming towards the Earth, and he says to himself, oh my God, if my figures are correct, we're all doomed. What can we do about it? That much of the material going up into the sky and that kind of an effect on the stratosphere in relation to letting the UV through, the ultraviolet waves, it could destroy the entire biosphere. Well, he got very active. He put the best science together he could. He looked at the larger patterns. He and his research partners got motivated and really worked hard. They went to hearings. They did public talks. They did their science as well as they could, and they really solved the problem, that problem. So I asked him, well, now what do we do about climate change? So this is the main part of what I want to talk about, the actual physical arrangements of a city that I think would be ecologically healthy. But I'll start with climate change. This is the upper reaches of the Yangtze River, where the glaciers are melting very rapidly. But it's caused by something more than anything else that the scientists at the climate change conferences of the UN aren't even talking about. You don't hear them talking about the arrangement of the city, urban design. It's not one of the things they're dealing with. But it is the largest thing human beings build, and it's the largest cause, so I want to talk about that. We live in something that is largely sprawl development. This is Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we're swamped in automobiles around the entire world, even places that you don't associate generally with automobiles, like Paris. We build parking lots that go up into the sky, 22 stories in this German city here. 50 miles of processing for oil into gasoline in Texas. This facility goes 50 miles across the landscape to the Gulf of Mexico. And then we're actually living in that, and we're causing problems like the drying of the Ural Sea. And here you can see a boat that's been left behind. Well, one of the interesting things is what I call the rust factor, too. We're going to have to have absolutely assiduous recycling if we want to have materials to build our society with into the deep future. Iron is plentiful, but it actually rusts. To actually get the ore in high enough concentrations to be economically viable, that we can bring it into our society, we have to expend energy. So there's an energy and materials formula going on here that says we have to be extraordinarily careful about what we're building and recycle absolutely assiduously, or we're going to lose the metals, especially the rare metals that are turning up now in all our high technology equipment that we think is very essential. Well, let's get down to the basics of the biggest. This is the beginning of what you might actually think of as an eco-city or an ecological city, a little town called Kunra, and it's located in Turkey. On ground level, you see bicycles for getting around, and most of the motorized vehicles are actually vehicles for business. Up above ground level, where the shops are, you have the living quarters for most of the people, and on the rooftops, you see solar collectors getting the heat from the sun instead of from firing up your natural gas or other energy sources from fossil fuels. So this is the beginning of the idea of an ecological city. There are a lot of these places around, but we have to think about that as we go about designing our cities. On the larger scale, Curitiba, Brazil is very well laid out. Back around 1972, they decided that in the expansion of the city, they would use the transit system to pull the density together so people would be living close to the transit system, close to one another, and that gave them the opportunity to have open space very close into the city itself. So five long arms of high density reach out from a very pedestrian core in Curitiba, and nothing but buses and emergency vehicles are allowed on those streets, which are called dedicated routes for the buses. And the mayor at the time, Jaime Lerner, actually invented this transportation system here where the bus comes in, and he invited the bus company, Volvo, to set up a factory in Curitiba, which they did, and designed a bus according to his specifications. And people can go out three abreast and in and out of the bus, and they've paid their fee at the turnstile. And so the result is that it's 85% as efficient as a subway system. And they claim it cost them only 1/300 because they didn't have to dig down into the earth and create all these extra systems that work with subways. And because they did that, here in Curitiba, they had an enormous amount of open space. They had reforestation projects and large parks for people and so on. Well, my organization, which is called EcoCity Builders, got started quite some time ago. One of the things we did way back in 1979 was celebrate the 80th anniversary of the first automobile fatality. And a long time ago, I thought I was going to become a sculptor, and I met a fellow named Paolo Soleri. In 1979, we unveiled this vegetable garden, and some people would say things like, gee, what if that happened to all our cars? And I thought, well, that's something to think about. But one thing is depaving. So we've done some depaving projects. If the world is made up largely of cars and paving and low-density development and fossil fuel industry, supply systems, and this is one way to approach the problem. Low-income housing project in Berkeley, changing the parking lot into a garden. And then on a slightly larger scale, we've brought back some creeks that have been buried underground, used $25,000 to get this project started from the state of California, rented a bulldozer, brought out about 375 volunteers in the course of, you know, working on weekends in small groups to create a canyon. Then we let the water flow back into the canyon, crushed the old culvert. A building was built on top of that next door. You can simply drive these posts into the ground. These are short pieces of willow. And within about 3 months, you get a willow that's sending roots out to stabilize the creek bed and also to start growing. And within about 5 years, that's what it looked like at that exact location. The creek critters come back. The kids now have nature in their world. They can see insects like this. This is one of the most macho insects you're ever going to find in the world. He's the top of his food chain, a dragonfly, that you can get so close to, you can't focus on it anymore. He's completely secure in his world. So the kids get that kind of an opportunity when you bring nature back into the city. And more cities are going for this. San Luis Obispo, This used to be filled with blackberry bushes and old shopping carts and tricycles and refrigerators, and now it's a creek in a city. And the largest project I know like that is where this highway used to be in the middle of Seoul, Korea. And now this is what it looks like. It's an artificial waterway partially, but it's in the bed of a creek and it runs with the creek's natural flow when it's the rainy season, but the water has to be pumped in the dry season. But the people love it. And it brings a little bit of nature and the function of water and the celebration of nature into the city. And though they look a little ratty in this picture, all those bushes in the background are labeled because they're natives and so on. And people can learn a little bit about nature in their city. Then there's powering it, powering the city, the eco-city of the future, and windmills. This is from for electricity, a picture in Spain. The wind actually can drive this recreational vehicle from the salt flats of Australia, the picture from the 1800s. And whole ships now, like the Windstar, which I photographed here just 3 weeks ago in Istanbul, traveling around the world, gets 60% of its energy from the wind. And it only has to burn fossil fuels as it does part of the time because it has to keep a tight schedule and so on for the tourists. Then you can design buildings that bring shade into the building in hot climates. This is Ken Yang's work, an architect from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. And you can also shade whole streets at the same with an umbrella like this in Singapore. So that's using shade and breezes. An artificial cloud, essentially, in Sinchin, China, by the architect Michael Chimchula. Very expensive to build something like that, but once built, all the buildings underneath it, which is a conference center and a city hall, run on much, much less energy in that hot climate because they're in the shadow of this enormous roof that's the size of 12 football fields. You can just imagine hanging cloth over streets just to keep the streets cool. Very simple, and marketplaces all over the world use it. And when I was in Istanbul a few weeks ago, this is what I saw. It's exactly what they're doing. Makes a very pleasant environment and keeps people very cool in these narrow streets. And say you're in a snowy climate, though this isn't that snowy. This is Milan, a very famous Galleria in Milan. But if it were a snowy climate or a colder area like Montreal, where they might be hosting our ninth International Eco-City Conference, you might want to reinforce that roof for the occasions when there's snow on it. But these sheltered streets are kind of fantastic. And this one has an edible creating the shade, which is a grapevine, once again in Istanbul. So you not only get the shade and the ambiance of a place like that and the freshening of the air, but you can actually get food. And one of the most interesting streets I know of, an interior street, and you can imagine these going through the middle of blocks, in a more dense city, is the Grand Bazaar of Istanbul. This is a pedestrian street in a totally car-free city called Bhaktapur. It's a medieval city in Nepal. And then you can work with the sun to collect energy. This is the work of Joachim Eble in a higher density place where you have these very small solar greenhouses essentially going up the side of an apartment building. So you can gather quite a bit of the sun in the high-density infrastructure. Or as in Tel Aviv, you can see the city practically glistens as if it had silver fish scales in the sun with solar hot water heaters. And I was there a few months ago also, and this is the research station for developing thermal solar energy in the middle of the desert, the Negev Desert near Tel Aviv. And that's me underneath this water boiler that's at 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit with 1,600 mirrors shining up there. Very impressive delivery of energy to apartment houses and cities and so on. And then there's rooftop gardens. They're becoming fairly popular. I don't really need to talk about them too much. And then the rooftop gardens of Vienna by Hundertwasser. And notice what happens when the seasons change because you've clad your buildings in living material. The actual trees changing from season to season looks rather like that. It's kind of an amazing change to have happening on your buildings in a large scale. And in Venice, you have a whole city held together by bridges, another one of the elements of the future eco-city. A man walking from a residential district in San Francisco to the business district, and in the distance you see bridges between towers in a downtown hotel. And then bridges for animals in Australia so that the animals can cross over the highways without getting killed. And here's one of my favorite. This is a tunnel so the salamanders can get under a highway without getting squashed in their migrations. And then for transportation, a lot of the traditional things like streetcars work just fine. Go for that. In Istanbul, again, you have a larger multiple streetcar chain essentially here. And then, of course, high-speed rail, as I was in a few months ago in China. And you look onto the inside of that, you're hurtling along at 150 miles an hour. And if you have a glass of water on a table, and some of those cars have tables in them, the glass doesn't even shimmer. You can't see ripples on the water, 150 miles an hour. We should be able to do that in the United States, where I come from, but we're not. Then here's a bicycle shop in Ningbo, China. Bicycles are magnificently efficient. I mean, they run on a flat surface at 1/8 the energy that you put into walking. And what about the better car? My thesis is the better car makes a worse city. Because if you continue the habit of driving around in a better car and you feel good about your better car, you're still paving the world. So you have to go from the automobile to the bicycle, foot traffic, and design for what I call access by proximity. You can get access by traveling there, or you can get access by designing things so things are closer together. It's a pretty simple formula. So I don't think that's the answer. The car-free city is much more the answer. Car-free cities exist. I mentioned Bhaktapur and showed you a picture of it. Venice, Italy is a car-free city. But what about the eco-home? Here we have the Atlantis ecological house concept with a rooftop garden, and you have a car on permeable paving, and you collect the water in a cistern, and it's pretty good, as those kind of houses go. And here are here's the family that's there. There's three people. But then you go to the apartment house I live in, Oakland, California, and I've visualized here a party for the 39 of us that live in the building on three times the amount of land, do the math. This property is serving 19 times more people, or 13 times, excuse me, more people per acre. And not only that, we don't have to get in a car to go do whatever we want to do. We have the cafes, the banks, the copy shops, the hardware stores and everything within three or four blocks. And we can even rent a car for occasions at a car rental place that's in downtown Oakland, only four blocks away. And it gets solar energy for hot water. And then you look at the suburban situation, an area where you need to clear snow, like Montreal. And here you see on this block, the snow removal device is working for maybe two dozen, three dozen people. And here it's working for maybe 300 or 400 people in the same path that the vehicle takes. So you get the efficiencies of density that are really important. And here we have a picture of the location I actually live in, but 250 years ago, an illustration in a book called The Ohlone Way that's about the Native Americans who lived there in the San Francisco Bay Area, but this is what it actually looked like. Incredibly biodiverse. And I have this here as the beginning of a little discussion on mapping. You can imagine where you used to be and what kind of nature you could recover in some degree, not thoroughly, of course, but a lot, and you know, like bringing the creeks in and so on. And so here's the zoning map of Oakland, and everything you see in tones of yellow is only one or two stories high, and then you have the strips of a little more density and commercial. We're suggesting a more centers-oriented approach that looks at the city and sees that you can withdraw from sprawl development. You can bring back the creeks. You can augment the size of the community gardens and bring agriculture right into the city if you densify. European cities take up about 1/3 the land per capita of American cities, United States cities anyway. And that means that 2/3 of the cities of the United States are paved over with city that's yearning to breathe free. You know, you could actually roll back sprawl if you had a system for doing it. So this little mapping system begins to explore that concept. So here you're centers-oriented, you move towards the centers, you refine the map, you find that you can restore marshlands, you can restore the creeks, you can have your viable city centers, and they're all linked by transit and bicycle. And you find in China, that's exactly the way the traditional villages are laid out, as tiny little villages surrounded by nature in a pattern rather similar. Edaw, Garrett Ekbo mentioned earlier, was one of the founding members of, is a landscape architecture firm that actually ran with this concept recently in a competition in Los Angeles and said, okay, the water's coming up, let's withdraw a certain level. I think they were thinking about 25 feet as a worst-case scenario. Let's learn about the watersheds and what they're all about. And they came up with the same idea that we've been promoting in EcoCity Builders since the mid-80s, which is to find your centers, locate those centers, work with them, reinforce them, then you can bring nature back in. In this process, they did for Los Angeles. And then at nighttime, instead of a large swath of low density, a sheet of light, you get little spots of light looking down from a satellite, say. Here you have a structure that's going from the international style towers or slabs, mostly single use, to the idea of a very complex structure that rises up over its warehousing and so on, can be supplied by trains instead of trucks down highways, and becomes an environment of very high mixed use and very compact development with beautiful views and held together by bridges and so on. The idea was pioneered by a fellow named Paolo Soleri. He came up with a concept he called Arcology, Architecture and Ecology, and I met him back in 1965 when I was 21 years old and decided cities really did need really serious attention, that he was quite right. The two-dimensional city doesn't work. Everything about living organisms that are complex says they have to be three-dimensional. All living organisms of any complexity are three-dimensional, not flat like a sheet of paper. We should learn this in the way we're building cities. They have to be compact. So here's one that runs on solar energy in the wintertime, gets all its heat that way, and you can walk and bicycle everywhere. You could imagine a bicycle and pedestrian city that looks like this. Platforms that are filled with developers' apartments and condominiums and so on, and the whole thing's unified by these passageways and so on. Or you can imagine little fractions of this kind of thing with highly mixed use, and this is the work of Paul Downton in Adelaide, Australia. And the idea here is to have an urban fractal, the fraction of the whole that has all the essential components present, close enough together that you don't have to travel much. Another interesting Australian, by the way, by the name of David Ingwich, had a very interesting way of talking about cities. He says the city is an invention for maximizing exchange and minimizing travel. And that exchange goes all the way down to social exchange, economic exchange, exchange of DNA, meeting the person you will be living with and having children with and everything. And so if you can make that smaller, you have the possibility of a real ecologically healthy city. And he's managed to build part of that, not the whole thing. That's him on a rooftop garden, Paul Downton in Adelaide, Australia. But whole cities have been built like that, whole villages in the past. This is an eco-village that has moved into an abandoned small town in northern Italy called Torri Superiori. And then Paolo Soleri has been building Arcosani. This is what it looks like now. I've always suggested that since he's talking about three dimensions, you should make it a little bit more three-dimensional. So my own remodel of Arcosanti, where I lived for a year once, would be to gather it together more like that, maybe augment it with more three-dimensionality. I think these images stimulate some thoughts about reorganizing the way we build cities. And then it goes through seasonal changes, like here we're putting in the garden, and now it's summertime. And you can see over in the right-hand center there, essentially, is the power tower of Bright Source Energy out in the desert that most electricity comes from. And I think you've got quite a few of the images and good ideas of reorganizing space.
You just heard ecological city designer Richard Register with a report on the best green living innovations from around the world. The speech was recorded by Alex Smith at Radio EcoShock at the Gaining Ground Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada, October 20th, 2009. Download the full speech with introduction by Rob Abbott with a brief Q&A as a free MP3 file from our website at ecoshock.org. Look for the Cities page in our audio on demand menu. Track Richard Register at his blog, ecocityviews.blogspot.com, and check out ecocitybuilders.org. If you are just tuning in, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, enjoying my swine flu. Now, another West Coast voice on a topic that's very hot. As recalls hit everything from cookware to baby toys, we can learn chemical self-protection from Portland's Elizabeth Grossman. Below the level of our sight, molecules of toxic chemicals are swirling around the world. Others arrive as consumer products in our kitchens and even baby toys. Elizabeth Grossman is an investigative journalist. Her new book is Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
And thank you so much for having me.
Your new book is creating waves in the mainstream media and the blogs. I've seen it in net forums. Why so much interest in the safety of consumer products now?
Well, I think we've become increasingly aware over the past 10 years or so, and even more in the past 2 or 3 years, that industrial sites, waste sites, factories, smokestacks, they're not the only sources of hazardous pollutants in our lives, and that, in fact, these kinds of chemicals are migrating out of products that absolutely permeate our lives.
Well, before we dig in a little deeper into that, can you give us just one example of a household product that emits dangerous chemicals?
Well, when you say the word emitting makes it sound like it's a pulsating beam, and I'm always really careful not to alarm people unduly, but virtually all the plastics that house electronics that might have been made in the past 3 or 4 years, and most upholstery that is of a similar age, all of those contain what are called brominated flame retardants, substances that have been put into those upholstery foams and plastics to prevent them from bursting into flame in case of fire. And it turns out that those chemicals, molecules of those chemicals, actually leave the products over time and under normal use. And testing that's been done by the Centers for Disease Control and numerous other agencies, organizations, medical groups have found that these chemicals are entering both household dust and our bodies and our food.
Yes, I've seen a program where famous people, big politicians and rock stars or whoever, have had their bloodstreams checked and they find 60 or 80 synthetic chemicals in them. We've all got them then.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned, the Centers for Disease Control here in the U.S. has been doing testing like this over the past 10 years and has consistently found dozens and dozens of different industrial chemicals, that a lot of which are emanating from household products. And in fact, the Environmental Working Group, an NGO in the U.S., released a report just last week where they had tested newborn babies' blood, and they had found, again, scores of chemicals in these infants' blood.
I'm interested that you brought that up, because on Radio EcoShock, I ran a feature on the work of Dr. Francisca Ferreira of the Columbia Milman School of Health, and she was able to prove scientifically that toxic molecules were penetrating the womb barrier of pregnant women, actually changing the DNA before birth. So are scientists wondering whether this could be adding to the rise in some health problems?
Yes, and in fact, the evidence is now overwhelming that environmentally available pollutants, the kind of chemicals we've just been talking to, are entering our bloodstreams and our bodies often before birth, and they are affecting particularly the hormonal systems, these very delicately balanced feedback systems that control virtually all our really vital body systems, metabolism, reproduction, development, neurological function, and all of the scientists I talked to for this book have said that based on everything they've seen, there is reason to be concerned that this kind of chemical exposure is indeed having an effect on the health of the public at large. And just in the past month, the American Medical Association adopted a scientific statement that was released earlier this year by the Endocrine Society saying that these kind of chemicals really should be decreased wherever possible, and we really should limit people's exposure to them.
Wow. So, but aren't these products regulated and tested by the government somehow?
Well, yes and no. And that's one of the great difficulties. Right now, there are over 80,000 industrial chemicals, chemicals that are registered to be used in commerce in the U.S. And we have a very cumbersome system of going and looking at them in detail. So while all manufacturers do some testing of these products, the kind of testing that has routinely been done does not capture all of the environmental and biological impacts that these chemicals might have, and the kind of hormonal effects, what are called endocrine disrupting effects we were just talking about, they are not routinely tested for at all. And in fact, under the rules we have in the U.S., the EPA has only been able to compel regulated thorough testing on about 200 of these 80,000 chemicals.
And how long do they last in the environment?
Well, it depends on the chemical. Here in the U.S. and in Canada, elsewhere around the world, we've been hearing a lot about a chemical, for example, called bisphenol A, which is the building block of polycarbonate plastics, the stuff that goes into those nice, lightweight, shatterproof, shiny water bottles we've been using. And that chemical is what scientists refer to as pervasive because it's everywhere. We use it just in so many plastic products and paper coatings, and it lines food cans, beverage cans. It's really everywhere in our lives. But it does not last a very long time in the environment, but we're exposed to it all the time. On the other hand, something like the brominated flame retardants I referred to, or the chemicals that make up nonstick surfaces in cookware, also similar chemicals make stain-resistant surfaces and grease-repellent coatings, those can last a really, really long time. Bits of them can last not just for days or weeks, but for months and possibly even years.
Now, in your book, Chasing Molecules, you describe going to a very remote Aboriginal settlement in Alaska. Why did you go there?
Well, I went to that community on St. Lawrence Island, and it's what we'd call a subsistence community here in the U.S. There are only two tiny villages on this island that is in Norton Sound off the west coast of Alaska. And one of the reasons I went is because the Arctic has become what scientists refer to as a sink for this kind of persistent chemical pollution, because everything that's released in the northern hemisphere that gets into atmospheric air currents or even into the oceans, eventually, if it lasts long enough, it will go north. And these kind of chemicals are collecting in the Arctic, and some of the highest levels that have been found in wildlife have been found in top Arctic predators like polar bears. They've had some of the highest levels of these nonstick, what are called perfluorinated compounds. And the community I went to visit is suffering from that kind of environmental pollution, but they also have pollution closer to home. They were a site for a number of years for defense operations, and when the military left, an enormous amount of hazardous chemical waste was left behind. So they've got kind of a double or triple whammy going on in terms of this kind of chemical impacts. I also went there because one of the things that's been discovered is that climate change, global warming, is creating conditions that seem to be exacerbating the impacts of this chemical pollution.
How does that happen?
Well, when stuff goes north and ends up in the Arctic, under normally cold conditions, anything that gets way up north and gets into ice and snow and permafrost, sea ice, it would be held in place simply by virtue of being frozen. As temperatures warm and the permafrost melts, sea ice melts, there's more wet precipitation instead of sort of drier snow, these chemicals are being released. The other thing some scientists have been finding is that as warming changes where Arctic polar animals have to go to look for food, they have to travel further, or because things are not arriving at the same time, they're burning more of their fat stores. And a number of these chemicals accumulate in fat. So when the animals burn their fat, they're releasing, along with the energy, some of the chemicals that have accumulated in their fat.
It's a kind of self-poisoning.
Exactly.
Well, You know, it's hard to imagine that there's this unseen layer of microscopic dust traveling around the globe. I've seen close-up photos of that dust, like soot from coal plants, for example, and those little particles, they look like tiny asteroids with many surfaces. And you're saying that any number of chemicals, including pesticides, hitchhike around the world unseen by any of us?
They do, and that's part of the reason why for this book I ended up trying to go places where these chemicals are going, because it is really hard to wrap your mind around this because you really can't see it. I was lucky enough to be able to go along with scientists on a couple of international polar year expeditions where all sorts of climate change research is being done, but also research into tracking these moving pollutants. And one of the really extraordinary things I got to see was some mapping that's now being done, not necessarily of these persistent chemical pollutants, but some of the other air pollutants that travel along with them, so that you could actually see these sort of colored pictures of plumes of chemical pollution. It was pretty amazing.
There are streams, it's like rivers of dust up in the atmosphere, way up and low down as well. Well, you know, we talked about babies in the womb, but then it doesn't stop there. What's the problem with children's plastic toys?
Oh, children's plastic toys. I was just on the Consumer Product Safety Commission website yesterday looking at their list of recalled products, and it's pretty disheartening. The problem with children's toys, essentially, for a lot of them, is we just don't know what's in them, and that problem's not necessarily limited to toys, but so many of these toys are made with plastics that we really don't know their origin. Very often, the manufacturers that have made your little explorer toy or action figure, little baby dinosaur toys, they're not 100% aware of the materials that they're using, where they came from. They're coated in paints that can have, unfortunately, lead or other heavy metals in them. And some of these toys are made with plastics that have kinds of plasticizers in them, things that make the base material flexible and bendable, particularly a category of chemicals with a funny name called phthalates, P-H-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S. And it turns out those also migrate out of the finished product, and they too have been identified as endocrine disruptors.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Elizabeth Grossman, author of the new book, Chasing Molecules. Elizabeth, you won't use Teflon frying pans. Why not?
Oh, well, I have this pan that I actually really, really like, and I stare at it kind of sadly, wondering, well, should I give it away, or is that bad too? I started reading about the chemicals that are used in Teflon, is a kind of a generic term, though it's a brand name, these kind of non-stick surfaces which are made up of chemicals based on fluorine chemistry. And when I read that these thing chemicals were turning up in polar bears and in sea turtles and having some seriously disturbing health impacts in terms of suppressing their immune system and leading to certain kinds of tumors and other health disorders, I just thought, oh, I really, really don't want to use those pans. And I started trying to find out what was in alternative pans that said they were nonstick but didn't have, quote-unquote, Teflon in them. And the short story is that because our laws are such that they really, really respect proprietary information from industries for all sorts of reasons, some of them probably very good and helpful if you're in business, we just don't know what's in this stuff. So I decided if I couldn't find out what it was, I was going to stick to my nice ceramic and cast iron pans.
Seems like a good solution. And really, we don't have to use these horrible chemicals that seep into our bloodstream. That's the good news part of your book, The Green Chemistry. Can you tell us about advances made to find safe replacements?
Yeah, I mean, there is now a movement, it's been around for about 10 years, but it's really just starting to get traction now, called green chemistry. And the basic idea behind that is that the best way of preventing chemical pollution, and therefore any of the health hazards that would come along with it, is by designing materials that are inherently environmentally benign and that are safe at every stage of that product's life, whether it's in the lab, during manufacturing, when the product's being used, or even when it might be disposed of or recycled. And this seems really simple, but it actually represents a pretty significant departure from how chemistry has been practiced commercially. Green chemistry is asking us to ask questions about environmental and health impacts of products at a point in design that simply haven't been asked before.
So if people get your book, are they going to be able to figure out better solutions for themselves?
Well, I will admit that my book was not intended to be a how-to, but one of the things I hope it will do is really make people aware that there are some absolutely extraordinary and dynamic scientists at work really hard on creating new, safe materials, and that this movement towards requiring materials to be safe is gaining some serious political traction, both in terms of what consumers are demanding and now in terms of what policymakers are asking. So I hope it will help people understand the problem and also how we're trying to solve the problem.
Yeah, I wonder, is the answer to try and go at it at the government level with regulations, or is it for consumers to say, I'm just not going to buy that product anymore? I mean, it's a little discouraging, I have to tell you, because I know people who devoted their lives in the 80s and 90s to some of these chemicals. We know about them, and yet we just keep on making them. What can we do?
I think the problem has to be gone at both ways. To a certain extent, in the past couple of years, I have to say it's kind of encouraging how fast the market is responding to consumers. Just take those polycarbonate water bottles, for example, and those plasticizers that are so prevalent in children's products. Just in the past couple of years, largely through consumer demand, enormous retail chains have just said, okay, we're not carrying this kind of chemical plastic product, particularly in children's products. So the market is actually moving fairly quickly. That said, I think we really do need some new regulations that will keep the most harmful chemicals out of products, and simply because voluntary things never work fast enough, I don't think. And I think we also need to make sure that the public has much better information than we do now under our current regulatory system.
And what have I left out? Is there something else you'd really like to tell our listeners as we wrap up here?
Well, I think one of the messages to take away from all of this is that it can be really, really overwhelming when you think about how many synthetic chemicals there are in all of our products. I asked virtually everybody I interviewed, what do you do? What do you recommend? And everybody said, don't panic. Be strategic. Make choices that are going to have the most impact in your life. If you have small children, babies, you know, make certain choices. Keep the stuff away from food. And the other big message, I think, is that we really need to make sure that safe products are easily and affordably available for everyone, that they're just the norm, and it's not something that you need a PhD and lots of spare time to try and figure out.
Yes, we could have a much less toxic world. Do you have a website for your book or some website you want to point out?
I do. Island Press, who's my publisher, has a website for the book. It's pretty simple. It's chasingmolecules.org, and there's love to have people take a look at that.
All right. This is Radio EcoShock from Portland. We've been speaking with Elizabeth Grossman, whose new book is popping up everywhere. It's called Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry, and it is published by Island Press. Thank you for all that good info, Elizabeth.
And thank you.
Our time is running out. Let's move straight to our next interview.
Many of us have stressful jobs, maybe a family to look after, and now the economy looks grim. How are we supposed to live a greener lifestyle with less money and a busier life? No need to panic or postpone, says our EcoShock guest, Prashant Vaze. He's an economist with 15 years' experience in Britain's Office of Climate Change and a part of the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit. but don't expect a lot of technical double talk in Prashant Bazet's new book. Sure, it's called The Economical Environmentalist, but the subtitle is My Attempt to Live a Low-Carbon Life and What It Cost. Let's get some ideas for our own lives. Prashant, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex.
It seems like a long stretch from government briefing papers to better choices at home. What set you on this path of personal exploration?
Well, I think I've been spending quite a bit of my time over the last 15 years, probably half of my time, I think, working on environmental and energy issues. And I was kind of using a lot of the techniques of cost-benefit analysis and working out how to spend money most efficiently for public policy goals. And I was becoming increasingly aware that, you know, this is something that you can't just leave to governments and businesses, but you have to do yourself. So I thought I'd try using the same kind of techniques and use it on my own life and just see where I was giving rise to emissions and what I could do to reduce them.
All right. Well, just to whet our appetites, can you give us an example of an easy change that saves money and carbon emissions at the same time?
It'll vary quite a bit between people. In my own circumstances, I found actually giving up my car, because of the main journey I make is up and down to Birmingham every fortnight, it was actually cheaper to give up the car, get onto one of the kind of car share schemes, and use the train instead. So that was something that saved quite a bit of money, about £2,000 a year, and it'll save about half the emissions because the train is so much more efficient in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. And also dietary changes can also save money as well, so that if you eat a lot less meat, it saves quite a bit of money and it makes a dramatic reduction in your greenhouse gas emissions because livestock in particular are very, very potent sources of greenhouse gases, especially methane.
Well, it is cheaper to just avoid buying the meat in the first place. But you mentioned the job situation. We can't all quit or move to the country, and jobs offer us plenty of excuses to burn up carbon. How did you reduce your pollution related to your work life?
I think my own job, I actually stopped working in the Office of Climate Change for a year so I could do some freelance consultancy and write this book. But I'm back in work now, and I find that there's a fair bit of discretion in a lot of, sort of travel-related emissions from work, and that's probably the biggest single source of my emissions from work. So a lot of the kind of things I did was suggest in the book that other people do is look again to see whether as much travel is really essential.
Well, thank you. I think it's also easier for single people to make new choices, but you have a family, and so do I. How do your kids react to your lifestyle changes?
By and large, they've been pretty enthusiastic. I think this My children are 9 and 11 years old, and I think partly because of, you know, the way that their mother and I have been bringing them up, they're very naturally quite inclined to this. At least in the UK, you know, the syllabus is very much changing towards encouraging kids to be more environmentally responsive. And so they've been quite up for it. I mean, my daughter in particular, she's quite into these things. My son takes a little bit of persuading about some of the sort of dietary changes and some of the kind of ideas of having less consumer goods at Christmas time and things. My wife was quite a pushover, actually, because she's already very heavily involved in Green Party. She's a Green Party politician, so there's no great problem there.
Yeah, I think a lot of parents would be surprised that their kids may end up taking a leadership role in pushing parents along and making the changes, because we're the ones stuck in our patterns.
That's certainly the case in the school where I'm a governor, where the eco-champions, which are essentially a group of one or two kids per class, they're very much at the forefront, and it's the teachers that are keen to drive to work, and essentially they're setting their sort of patterns of energy consumption.
I noticed, too, that you worry about the need to visit family overseas, and many of us are in that situation. George Monbiot calls these long-distance flights love miles. It's a serious problem. What did you work out about that situation?
Well, in my own circumstance, I mean, I've got Indian origins, so my family are spread over literally four continents, and there's a constant kind of obligation of weddings and, you know, various different family events to go to. What I kind of noticed was that as you let people know the kind of changing priorities in your life, you have to sort of try to organize trips that you do so that they make much more use of actually seeing people at the same time. So it is hard. So we're very reliant on emails and very reliant on things like Skype. So we still keep in touch.
And I read in one review that the reviewers said that you said that rich people create a lot more pollution than the rest of us, that the wealthiest 10% in Britain put more carbon into the atmosphere flying around than the total emissions of all the poorest people in the country. Is that true? And what can we do about that?
Well, the disparity is very, very stark. I mean, we're very used to sort of seeing these kind of nationwide averages where, you know, Americans and Canadians are emitting 20 plus tons of CO2 and Brits 10. But the differences are just as stark within a country. So in the UK, the richest 10% of households emit something like four times more than the poorest 10%. And as you say, one of the statistics that really surprised me, but it shouldn't really, because knowing my own sort of flying patterns previously, it's quite true that the emissions from flying from the richest 10% were equivalent to all the gas and electricity and transport emissions from the poorest 10%. What do we do about it? Well, it's a very interesting question. I mean, in the UK, there's quite a lot of public policy to ensure that the poorer households have adequate energy just to keep warm and electricity. But there's no equivalent constraints on the richest households. And in fact, it's almost a badge of honour that as people become wealthier, they start indulging in more energy-intensive activities like long-distance travel. You know, my own hope is that either through this kind of decisions that people are making to cut back on their emissions.
Well, we need some sort of new ethical picture for how wealth is used, I think. But you've also brought up one of the big picture questions that I have, which is heating a home is one of the big challenges for reducing fossil fuel emissions. Do you cover that in your book?
Yeah, I mean, it's, for my own house, it was the single largest source of emissions. So I was emitting about 3.5 tons. In the UK, we're actually blessed with quite a gentle climate. Scandinavian friends have much more extreme problems. Essentially go through the house, look at the external surfaces, see where heat is being lost. And in my own house, quite a large source of loss is actually is ventilation. Another big source of loss is the windows and the walls. You know, it's really a two-stage process. One is just trying to work out where you can make the most cost-effective savings, and then trying to schedule that work so it kind of makes sense given the kind of plans you might have to update your house. So we're in the process of doing that over the next 2 or 3 years. So we've done half the windows so far, we've done the draft proofing, and it's made quite substantial reductions. So I think by the time we finish, we'll have probably cut off about two-thirds of the emissions from the house.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Prashant Vazi, a longtime economic advisor to the British government. He's now the chief economist at Consumer Focus, the UK's largest consumer group. Well, you've had the advantage of working with other local groups trying to reduce carbon emissions as a community. That movement has barely started here in North America. What do these local community groups do to minimize the ecological footprint?
I mean, there's quite a variety of different groups in the UK and even within the area that I live in. I was active in probably about two, maybe three different groups. I used to run something called Camden Climate Action Network, and that was essentially an information exchange one. So it was posting emails, letting people know of events and things going on. There's another group which is essentially trying to set up information exchange about reliable builders, contractors who will come in and do your house, charge a fair price. They're much more kind of focused around helping people locate quality suppliers. And the third type of thing people do is provide services locally. So, for instance, there's a network which I know is very well known in North America, FreeCycle, just to exchange and reuse goods, because obviously the embodied emissions in goods is a very, very substantial source of emissions. We've also got a local farmers market, which is essentially set up by sort of a central body which vets to make sure that the farmers are coming in from reasonably local nearby. And the kind of organic stands and stuff. So this is essentially providing a mixture of services, information, or just moral support. And I think that's very important because doing this kind of thing alone can be quite an isolating thing. But when you do it amongst a group of people, like-minded people, then it becomes the new norm. And it's very important that psychologically you have that support.
Yes, to have that support group. I noticed, too, your book, The Economical Environmentalist, isn't totally about personal responsibility. For example, you bring up the role of big corporations. Can you tell us about lobbying by General Electric to stall laws requiring more efficient light bulbs?
Yeah, that was quite funny, actually, because, I mean, light bulbs is something which is, in many ways, an absolute no-brainer. I mean, you know, we've had light bulb technology which can shave off 80% of emissions. This technology's been around for quite some time. But mysteriously, General Electric decided to go it alone and introduce essentially just a twist on the old tungsten filament, which is somewhat more efficient, but unlike compact fluorescence, lit up immediately. So they thought that this was actually going to be a more sensible way for consumers to go. I think a lot of it was actually just mistiming that they invested money in developing this type of technology. Essentially, didn't quite appreciate that governments throughout the world, in Europe and Australia, were actually going for the much more extreme compact fluorescence and banning tungsten-based light bulbs.
Are those compact laws going ahead in Europe and Australia?
Yeah, they've already in the UK, it actually came into force earlier this year. So now for the 100-watt tungsten filament, it can no longer be sold. So I'm very much in favour of where, essentially, it's a no-brainer kind of decision. Get the technology working and then regulate to make it penetrate into the market very quickly. But there's very few examples like that where essentially things have been banned because of the poor energy efficiency performance. But I think there's scope for more of that.
Prashant, I'm hoping we can do two more things with our remaining time. First of all, I'd like to point readers to your website at www.economicalenvironmentalist.co.uk. People can find useful forms there and a carbon footprint calculator. Briefly, how do I use that?
Well, the calculator I've developed intends to be a reasonably sophisticated one, so it goes the same kind of calculations which I did in my book. So unlike other calculators, it has formulae to look at food effects and also some of the waste effects, which is quite unusual. There's also a fairly detailed calculator which allows you to enter in the size of your walls and your windows, so you can look at the heat losses. But instead of just entering information about your electricity bill and your gas bill, it actually allows you to essentially unpack where the heat loss is occurring. I'm going to be trying to simplify it a little bit more over time.
Well, my second goal is to get a few more examples we can all use, simple ways to save money and energy and emissions. Can you give us some more tips from the book, maybe even about microwaving instead of using the stove or something like that?
Yeah, sure. I've got about 40 different gadgets. So the first thing I did was just go around measuring how much these are on and whether they need to be plugged in. So my first job was essentially just walking around with a very sort of simple meter just to plug in the how many gadgets were necessarily just drawing energy just for no reason. And some of the sort of cheaper electronic goods I bought were using pretty much the same amount of electricity as about 2 or 3 years as the purchase price of the good itself. So those ones, you know, I immediately switch off. I also thought a little bit about how to actually cook more efficiently, because if you think about something like a simple action like boiling an egg, you're basically heating up to a kilo of water in order to cook 50 grams of egg, and plus the kind of loss of the power and all that kind of thing. So I tried various different options, and one I definitely do not recommend is trying to sort of boil an egg in a microwave. But a microwave is a good way of actually making scrambled eggs, so that's something I do advocate. I mean, typically, microwaves work by only heating the water in the actual the food. So rather than necessarily heating pan and water and things like this, you can actually be a lot more efficient. And similarly, you know, things like making cups of tea, do you really need to raise the water to 100 degrees centigrade? Is a lower temperature okay? And, you know, do you need to use electricity or gas? So the best option is really just to measure accurately how much water you need, put in a kettle, and then just gas to heat the water. So this is looking at the embodied emissions within the fuel and the amount of food that you're heating or unnecessarily heating and the temperature to which you're heating.
As a result of your explorations, what have your emissions added up to?
I mean, to begin with, I was emitting around 11 tons, which is pretty much the norm for the UK.
Per year?
Per person in the household. I was probably flying quite a bit more than the average UK person. The various things that I'm bringing in, some of them are achieving about 60%. So the reductions in my food and my heating the home have been about 60%. Travel, if I sell the car, it'll be 50%. The flying, I had a pretty bad year when I actually did the measurement. The emissions rose, but since then I've not flown. So that's been quite dramatic. I think overall I managed to achieve 34% reduction between the base year and last year. But this year it's fallen yet again. So if we are really striving to reduce emissions by 30-40% over the next decade, by far the fastest way is really by these kind of behavioral changes, by actually thinking about the demand side. So this isn't the only solution. Obviously, some things have to be done centrally, such as electricity, the fuel mix in there, some of the kind of technologies to electrify vehicles. But there's a lot that can be done by households who are actually motivated and think through how and why they're using energy in their homes.
You've been listening to advice from Prashant Veze, a top-level economist who explored ways to live a more environmentally responsible life. His journey and his helpful tips are in the new book, The Economical Environmentalist, My Attempt to Live a Low-Carbon Life and What It Cost. That's published by EarthScan. Find out more at www.earthscan.co.uk. Prashant, thanks so much for sharing your results with us.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
This is EcoShock Radio. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
That's it for this week. I've left the Copenhagen climate struggle until the dust settles, and we've got our annual Green Music Special coming up in a couple of weeks. If you have songs to nominate, write me. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thanks for listening.